And welcome back to the Tom Hartmann University Book Club. Today we're reading from The Last Hours of Humanity, Warming the World to Extinction, a book about extinction. The climate scientists' warnings have come true. There is more carbon in our atmosphere, trapping heat and moisture, than ever before in the 165,000-year history of the human race. We are on the verge of the first ice-free summer in the Arctic in 3 million years. And back then, the Earth was a very different place from the one currently cradling us. The consequences of a warming planet are appearing much faster than had been projected by climate scientists of just a decade ago. The most dire warnings, rising oceans, freak storms, and agricultural collapse, they're all taking place right now. And it's going to get worse. But now other voices have entered the fray. Those of geologists who study the longer-term implications and histories of a planet undergoing rapid global warming. Specifically, they are focused on extinctions. The climate scientists, geologists, and those from related scientific disciplines need to continue talking to each other because at some point we may be able to see the critical moment in which the current climate crosses from the realm of a global destabilizer to a global extinction event. We must wake up. It's hard to imagine life without Earth. We take the vast variety of life on this planet and even our own existence for granted. But numerous times in our planet's history, life as we know it has come close to it disappearing entirely. We call these events mass extinctions, and we even teach school children about those times of great death on our planet. For example, we know that long ago, on a much more unstable planet, the dinosaurs were killed by an asteroid striking the Earth. This leads many people to believe that as long as we don't see an asteroid hurtling toward the planet, all is well. But this is not rational thinking for several reasons. The asteroid impact that killed the dinosaurs and started a major mass extinction is the only event having to do with outer space that we can trace with any certainty. And new science indicates that the asteroid impact itself wasn't what killed the dinosaurs. It was the global warming that followed it. New science has discovered a common theme in all of the extinctions in the past. And it's woven right into the global fabric of today as yet another mass extinction threatens our planet. That global consistent thread is global warming. We have had 6 extinctions in the billion-year history of life on our planet. Each sharp spike in the chart below indicates one of these mass extinctions. There's a chart on the page. Occurring about 450 million years ago, the Ordovician/Silurian mass extinction devastated marine life, which at the time dominated the planet. In a series of 2 extinctions, 60 and 70% of all life on the planet was taken, respectively. Then, fewer than 100 million years later, the planet was rocked again. The Dinovian period was capped off by a 20-million-year death march. It killed off 70% of life on Earth. This included many coral reefs, which didn't return for another 100 million years. We know of the KT extinction, the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction, which occurred 65 million years ago, ending the reign of the dinosaurs. There was also an extinction event 200 million years ago, known as the Triassic-Jurassic mass extinction. But none of these extinctions explains the huge spike shown in the center of the previous chart. That one happened 250 million years ago and was the worst mass extinction of species event in the history of our planet. It was the extinction of all extinctions, referred to as the Great Dying. The Permian mass extinction took out at least 95% of all life on the planet in fewer than 100,000 years, an instant in geological time. Professor Paul Wignall of the University of Leeds and an expert on mass extinctions told me that the Permian was the greatest crisis that life on Earth has ever suffered. Only in the past 2 decades has the cause of the Permian extinction been understood. It was speculated that an asteroid impact may have been the trigger, but more recent research by Professor Wignall, geologists, and other scientists around the world have revealed the true trigger came from deep within the Earth. The Permian mass extinction was initiated by a colossal flow of lava in an area of what is now Siberia. That was the trigger, but not the killer. The killer was under the water and under the ice, where trillions of tons of greenhouse gases, largely derived from carbon, and frozen in the form of crystalline methane, lay in wait. Thus, global warming is the force behind the death of nearly everything on the planet during the Permian mass extinction. That point is well illustrated. You can again see the spikes of mass extinctions measured by the increase in global temperatures, with the largest spike representing the Permian mass extinction. Wignall told me, There have been a lot of disasters and crises in the geological past. It's interesting to study them because they may have a comparison to today. He added, I think it is certainly extremely significant that a lot of the main crises of the past are associated with global warming, with obvious implications for the present day. The sixth mass extinction may even rival the speed and intensity of the Great Permian mass extinction, but the sixth is not represented on either of the two previous charts. That's because it's the one happening today, right now, all around us. And then we go on to document how the burning of fossil fuels is throwing an amount of carbon into the atmosphere, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, that's relatively similar to what happened with that giant volcanic eruption in Siberia 250 million years ago with the Permian mass extinction, and how it could be leading to a major extinction event. The book is The Last Hours of Humanity, Warming the World to Extinction.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on in the world today. NBC and Megyn Kelly and Alex Jones and Donald Trump tweeting. And is the Republic safe? And over the weekend, we had the anniversary of Watergate. In the next hour, Lamar Waldron's going to be with us for the hour to talk about that, the author of The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. Danny Goldberg is going to be with us in our third hour to talk about a new project that he's got, In Search of the Lost Chord. And, there's a lot going on. And tomorrow is the election in Georgia's 6th District. Chris, you have the ad for that, don't you? Can we play that right now? There's a new ad playing by Karen Handel against John Ossoff. Karen Handel, the old Secretary of State, who purged the voting rolls in Georgia, including in the 6th District, of tens of thousands of African-Americans and Korean-Americans, oddly enough. There's a Koreatown is in the 6th District. And now she's running for that seat. You know, Greg Ballas was on the show last week talking about this. Anyway, here's the ad that's running.
Now the unhinged left is endorsing and applauding shooting Republicans. When will it stop? It won't if John Ossoff wins on Tuesday, because the same unhinged leftists cheering last week's shooting are all backing John Ossoff. And if he wins, they win. Stop them. Stop them now. Stop John Ossoff. Stop Nancy Pelosi. Vote Karen Handel for Congress. Vote. Principled Leadership Project PAC paid for this ad and is solely responsible for its content.
Now, this is paid for by an opaque super PAC. We don't know who the donors are. If you go to opensecrets.org, they have no information. One of the wonderful things the Supreme Court brought us. Both parties, the Republican Party in Georgia and the Democratic Party in Georgia, have condemned this ad and Ben said, yes, it's also not true. But hey, this is the state of American politics. Meanwhile, in Germany, every party, this from a piece in The Atlantic, Why Germany's Politics Are Much Saner, Cheaper, and Nicer Than Ours by Olga Kazan, published in September 30th, 2013. Each party creates just one 90-second ad for the entire election. The number of times in the last U.S. election, we spent $400 million in TV ads, but the TV is free in Germany. Each party gets a certain number of minutes for their ads. German campaigns will last only 6 weeks. The German party, the German government, pays about 2/3 of all the costs of all the campaigning. There are absolute, limits on what can be contributed. The last major election, Angela Merkel running, the entire election from the chancellor all the way down to, I think her title is chancellor, all the way down to local county elections, the entire election cost 20 to 30 million euros. Whereas German politicians don't spend any money at all raising funds, whereas in the United States, the average American politician at the federal level spends 4 to 5 hours a day begging special interests for money, Republicans and Democrats. And Germany, as a result of all this, has 71% voter participation. We have 57%. So serious stuff. In the context of all that, Julio Rivera is with us. He's the editorial director of Reactionary Times, columnist with Newsmax, Right Wing News, and Politichicks. And reactionarytimes.com is the website, and you can tweet him at, oh, yeah, it's Julio. Julio, welcome.
Hey, how are you, Tom? A lot of interesting stuff there that I hear you saying. Obviously the ad that was run by that super PAC was probably in poor taste, in a sense, because I don't really necessarily see a lot of people on the left, the conventional left, maybe the fringe left, were cheering what occurred. But the fact of the matter,
there's nobody cheering what occurred, Julio. Violent. There's nobody cheering it. Period.
Well, the guy
was a domestic abuser, and just like nobody was cheering on the right, to the best of my knowledge, when Gabby Giffords was shot. I mean, that's like nobody is cheering that. Drop that.
Well, listen, why do we have these violent Antifa protests? Why do we have in Berkeley when there's just an exchange of different ideas and thoughts when Ben Shapiro?
That's a whole completely different topic, Julio. We're talking about what money in politics here. We've got an election in Georgia where you've got a bunch of billionaires in hiding funding a hit ad that is so offensive that even the Republicans in Georgia have condemned it, but it's still on the air. And this is how money in politics has corrupted America. And, whether it's labor unions doing something at the last minute to help a Democrat, or whether it's billionaires at the last minute doing something to help a Republican, this is wrong. Would you not agree?
No, well, there's billionaires helping the Democrats, too, and there's dirty ads all over. We just went through
let's get rid of them.
Cycle where there were dirty ads being posted by both sides.
Let's stop it.
Think that this is something that should reflect poorly on the Republican candidate at all. And the campaigns are strictly prohibited from coordinating with the super PAC.
Yeah, right.
Obviously, this should not reflect on the campaign being run by the Republican.
Well, I'm trying to separate the issue here, which I'd like you to speak to. I have not heard a word from you about it. Should we in America reverse the Buckley versus Vallejo decision? And 1976, that struck down most of the campaign finance reforms in 73 and 74 that were passed on a bipartisan basis. In fact, mostly Republicans led the charge for this stuff after Richard Nixon resigned. Should we pass a constitutional amendment or something like that? Should we do, or whatever it takes to reverse the Supreme Court decision and say, no, we are going to have limits on money in politics in the United States because money is a corrosive and corrupting influence. Left, right, doesn't matter.
Well, that I can most certainly agree with. I'll be honest with you. I mean, I think that people should be contributing directly with a limit to the candidates directly. I don't like the way that the super PACs handled a lot of things. Obviously, this most recent ad, there was a lot of things that went on during the presidential primary that I didn't agree with as well, either with some of the things that the super PACs did, like, the whole thing with Ted Cruz's wife, the unflattering picture. And then, there was just a lot of things. There was a lot of dirty, ugly things that happened in the last campaign cycle. I agree with that. That's something that one of the rare times that I will agree with.
So how do you think we should do it?
We should have limits.
How do you think we should do it?
I think that what they should do is they should write it that private citizens can donate directly to the candidates up to the $5,400 limit per cycle, per primary and per general election, the way that they basically what they have now. They should eliminate maybe the super PACs or really deeply reform it.
Yeah. Huh. Wow. Julio, I'm impressed.
I don't agree with you in theory on a lot of things because I think that you're – as a Bernie Sanders type of democratic socialist, that's how I see you, wrong.
That's reasonably accurate.
What was that?
I said that's a reasonably accurate portrayal of me.
Okay, well, I don't believe in that either. I don't believe in wealth redistribution. Wealth redistribution at its core is immoral. I don't think that anybody's entitled to something that somebody else has earned. I believe in a totally free market. So
yeah, well, that's a whole completely separate argument.
I'm a believer in the free market.
You're
a good guy.
Back to money and politics, the argument that the billionaire class has made, and they've made it through a series of lawsuits, and this is how they got it before the Supreme Court in 1976, and it came about in large part as a result of the 1971 Powell memo, and Lewis Powell, ironically, then also wrote the Buckley decision in 76, and in 71, in his memo to Eugene Sindor, his neighbor and the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, he said, business has to get into politics. Businesses had been apolitical until 1971. Businesses, by and large, had not been backing political candidates. and you know, they've thrown in full bore. So if we agree that individual campaign donations should be limited to $5,400, and should that just be it, or is there a role for government funding in political campaigns? And what do you do about labor unions and big corporations?
Well, I think you have to severely limit the influence of big corporations and labor unions, especially. I don't have a problem with that whatsoever. I mean, I am totally in agreement with that. I think it should be more driven by the people. I mean, like, you know, you always like to say that there is no government. It is only we the people. I think the government should not have influence, obviously, in the way these elections are carried out, because everybody has an agenda, and it's usually not the purest of agendas.
Yeah.
And I think that they exert.
Well, what about the Supreme Court's assertion in Citizens United in 2010 that corporations should have the right to contribute to campaigns as well, that their voices being the most informed actors in the economic arena, I think was the language that Scalia used.
Limitations, though, with limitations to a certain extent. Like I said, we have to reform it. I'm not for all out wiping it out completely, but let's look to reform it as much as we can and as best as we can.
Yeah. Okay. Julio Rivera, interesting conversation. Editorial director of Reactionary Times, columnist with Newsmax, Right Wing News, and Politichicks. You can tweet him at Oh Yeah, It's Julio, and J-U-L-I-O. Julio, thanks for talking with me today.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom.
Have a great afternoon. We will be back right after this. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back in just a minute with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. And welcome back. Howard watching Free Speech TV in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, what's on your mind today? Happy Monday.
Can you hear me, Tom?
Yeah, just fine, Howard.
Okay. I want to talk about the donut hole.
Mm-hmm.
Prescription drugs.
Oh, yeah. Is it Medicare or is it?
Medicare.
Yeah, Medicare Part D, I guess it is.
Of course, I had open heart surgery, and I have to take a lot of drugs. And usually about August or September, I go into the donut hole.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked my druggist, I said, how long do I have to, you know, put up with this? Because the drugs are very expensive, of course.
Right.
And he told me, well, it's supposed the Republicans and the Democrats get together. They revised the law, and by the year 2020, everybody will come out of that donut hole.
Right. That's the Affordable Care Act that the Republicans are trying to repeal right this minute.
Right. This is what Trump wants to do. He wants to keep us in the donut hole.
Right.
Yeah.
No, seriously. Yeah.
A lot of senior citizens don't realize what this guy is actually doing to us.
Yeah, no, he's a complete shill for the banksters, the billionaires, the petro billionaires, the transnational corporations, the Saudi, you know, any country where he has a Trump hotel, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, has a big Trump property there, and you know, they're going after Qatar and Al Jazeera now, and Trump is on the side of the UAE. Trump tried to open a hotel in Qatar. They said no. And so now he's calling them terrorists, even though they're a Sunni Muslim theocracy or, you know, kingdom, just like all the rest of them. You know, the Philippines, he's got a big Trump hotel there. So he calls up Duterte and says, good job killing those drug users. I mean, it's just totally, totally bizarre.
Yeah.
These are Trump's interests. It's not what he campaigned on. He campaigned on being a Democrat, essentially. But he is governing like a plutocrat.
I whenever I get a chance, I just came from the drugstore, and there are some senior citizens standing around. I seen them, and I knew, and I said to them, did you know that Trump wants to keep the donut hole? And they looked at me with their faces like they were like amazed.
Yeah.
And they don't know. I tell you that this is his plan, is to keep the donut hole.
Yeah, the real simple way to convey it to people is Obamacare closed the donut hole. It's going to take another 4 years to make it happen, but Obamacare closed the donut hole. And repealing Obamacare, which is what the Republicans are behind closed doors in the Senate right now scheming to do, repealing Obamacare will restore the donut hole. Because then you'll just have Medicare Part D the way it was written back in 2003.
So we have to, whenever we can. Goodbye, Tom.
Yeah. Okay, Howard, thanks a lot for the call. It's nice to hear from you, and a great topic. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. Stick around.
On April 15, 1949, Pacifica Radio KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California, went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America.
And there was a guy named Charles Hutto who actually participated in the massacre years later. Well, he said, I was 19 years old, and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should be even a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind.
Howard Zinn, Virtual Optimism, The Other Side of American History. Did you know that you can get most any of the 50,000 Pacifica broadcasts in our collection? Visit us online at PacificaRadioArchives.org and help support the Archives mission to preserve Pacifica's broadcast legacy.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, it is this week is the beginning of summer. And every summer, because things are slower in the summer and, you know, people are taking vacations and we see about, I don't know, probably a 10-15% drop off in participation in our program. And I think it's largely a result of that. It's just, you know, in any random week during the summer, probably a certain percentage of our audience is, you know, camping out or, you know, visiting mom or whatever. And so during the summer, we always go to Anything Goes Summer. You don't have to only call. Typically, we try to set a topic or a couple of topics for every hour and ask outside of Fridays and ask people to just call in on topic, right? But from now until the fall, we're going to do Anything Goes Summer. So if there's something you want to talk about that I haven't mentioned, feel free to call. I mean, you know, within rational limits, but by and large, feel free to call. And you got that, Nate, right? Yeah, Nate's nodding. Okay. Theresa May. This is fascinating. This is from Evolve Politics. And Theresa May, of course, is the leader of the Conservatives in Great Britain and the Tories. And their politics are not unlike Republican politics in the United States. In fact, that was Maggie Thatcher's party in 78 when she became prime minister. And then, of course, Reagan in 80, and the two of them were like two peas in a pod. And the British Tories and the Republicans in the United States have been kind of in lockstep ever since, although most Republicans don't realize that the British Tories, the British Conservatives, still think that there should be a National Health Service. They think parts of it should be privatized, but they still think it should be there. They still think there should be a strong social safety net. They would never think of doing away with the British equivalent of Social Security. But anyhow, there are some differences. So, for example, this is the Evolve Politics part. Theresa May, she says, the government I lead will be driven not by the interests of the privileged few, but by your interests. This was a speech during the campaign when she was running. And when it comes to taxes, we will prioritize not the wealthy, but you. When we pass new laws, we will listen not to the mighty, but to you. And then you look at how she votes. She's a member of parliament. She voted against banking reforms in 2013. She voted against an acting on soaring energy bills in 2013. She voted against increasing the tax rate applied to income over 150,000 British pounds. She voted against proposals to reduce tax avoidance and evasion in April 2016. She voted against building 100,000 affordable homes in 2013. She voted against creating more jobs for young people funded by a tax on bankers' bonuses. She voted against higher benefits for the most severely disabled. She voted against the mansion tax on the wealthy. And she voted for the bedroom tax on the poor. Now, those things are more meaningful to people in the UK than they are probably to you. And I don't want to go into this whole detail of it. But, you know, so that's what's happening in Great Britain. And the Brits are starting to say, hey, wait a minute. I mean, this is why Jeremy Corbyn damn near became prime minister and still might. Meanwhile, here in the United States, since 1978, the source, EPI, Bloomberg, and U.S. Labor Department, this is from Occupy Democrats. Since 1978, right, since Reagan, the cost of college tuition has increased by 1,100%. Medical care has gone up by 600%. Food has increased by 244%. The cost of shelter has gone up 380%. Meanwhile, the pay of typical workers rose by just 10%. The pay of minimum wage workers fell by 5.5%. And the average CEO's pay increased by 937%. And Shades, S-H-A-D-Z, tweets this along with a picture saying, why is it easier to believe that 150 million Americans are being lazy rather than that 400 Americans are being greedy? That is, there are 400 Americans who own as much wealth or have as much, who have the same amount of income as 150 million Americans. And so this is where we're at, right? You know, I mean, the politics of this. And a fascinating piece in the New York Times today, the car was repossessed, but the debt remains, is the title of the article. It's by Andrew Ross Sorkin. It's the Deal Book. And he talks about how the new debt bubble is car loans, subprime car loans. There's hundreds of billions of dollars of these things out there. And people can't just walk away from them like they can a home loan, a home mortgage. And it's a potential time bomb for our economy. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
I want to talk about the London mosque attack over the weekend, too. This man who was arrested on a suspicion of attempted murder. And then we'll pick up your calls. Hi, it's the Tom Hartman University Book Club. We're reading today from Rebooting the American Dream, from the introduction. It's titled Back to the Future. On April 14th, 1789, George Washington was out walking through the fields at Mount Vernon, his home in Virginia, when Charles Thompson, the Secretary of the Continental Congress, rode up on horseback. Thompson had a letter for Washington from the President pro tem of the new constitutionally created United States Senate, telling Washington that he'd just been elected president. And the inauguration was set for April 30th in the nation's capital, New York City. This created two problems for George Washington. The first was saying goodbye to his 82-year-old mother, which the 57-year-old Washington did that night. She gave him her blessing and told him it was the last time he'd see her alive, as she was gravely ill, and indeed she died before he returned from New York. The second problem was finding a suit of clothes made in the United States of America. For that, he sent a courier to his old friend and fellow general from the American Revolutionary War, Henry Knox. Washington couldn't find a suit made in America because in the years prior to the American Revolution, the British East India Company, whose tea was thrown into the Boston Harbor by outraged colonists after the Tea Act of 1773 gave the world's largest transnational corporation a giant tax break, but the British East India Tea Company controlled the manufacture and the transportation of a whole range of goods, including fine clothing. Cotton and wool could be grown and sheared in the colonies, but it had to be sent to England to be turned into clothing. This was a routine policy for England, and it's why until India achieved its independence in 1947, Mahatma Gandhi, who was assassinated a year later, sat at his spinning wheel for his lectures and daily spun clothing in his own home. It was, like his salt march, a protest against the colonial practices of England and an entreaty to his fellow Indians to make their own clothes to gain independence from British companies and institutions, even though making their own clothes or making their own salt was against British law. Fortunately for George Washington, an American clothing company had been established on April 28, 1783, in Hartford, Connecticut, by a man named Daniel Hinsdale. And it produced high-quality woolen and cotton clothing, as well as items made from imported silk. It was to Hinsdale's company that Knox turned, and he helped Washington get, in time for his inauguration 2 weeks later, a nice, but not excessively elegant, brown American-made suit. He wore British black later for the celebration and the most famous painting, but he was sworn in wearing an American-made suit. When Washington became president in 1789, most of America's personal and industrial products of any significance were manufactured in England or in other British colonies. Washington asked his Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, what could be done about that, and Hamilton came up with an 11-point plan to foster American manufacturing, which he presented to Congress in 1791. By 1793, most of its points had either been made into law by Congress or formulated into policy by either President Washington or the various states, which put our country on a path of developing its industrial base and generating the largest source of federal revenue for more than 100 years. Those strategic proposals built the greatest industrial powerhouse the world had ever seen. And after more than 200 successful years, Alexander Hamilton's program was only abandoned during the administrations of Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, and remained abandoned to this day. Modern-day China, however, implemented most of Hamilton's plan just in the 1990s and has brought about a remarkable transformation of its nation in a single generation. Hamilton's 11-point plan for American manufacturers is a primary inspiration for this book. It was part of a larger work titled Alexander Hamilton's Report on the Subject of Manufacturers, made in his capacity as Secretary of the Treasury. It's the official title. And then I list Hamilton's 11-point plan for American manufacturers. And I'll share just the headlines of this. He starts out by saying, a full view now having been taken of the inducements to the promotion of manufacturers in the United States, in other words, why we should do this, accompanied with an examination of the principal objections, which are commonly urged in opposition. This was Jefferson's objection that he didn't want America to be a manufacturing nation. He wanted us to be an agricultural nation. Hamilton says, it is proper in the next place to consider the means by which it may be effected. So here he says, in order to a better judgment of the means proper to be presented to the United States, it will be of use to advert to those which have been employed with success in other countries. In other words, we're stealing this idea from England. It was called the Tudor Plan when King Henry VII came up with it. So number one, protecting duties, import taxes, now called tariffs, or duties on those foreign articles which are the rivals of domestic ones intended to be encouraged. So number one, raise the cost of imported goods. Number two, prohibition of rival articles or duties equivalent to prohibitions. On some things that we think it's really important to make in America, make the duties, the tariffs, so high that nobody would want to import them, so there'll be a strong domestic manufacturing presence. Three, prohibitions on the exportation of materials of manufacture. Why provide raw materials to other countries, like we're doing right now to China, to make stuff to sell back to us when we can simply make it here, manufacture it here? Number four, pecuniary bounties. This is one of the most efficacious means of encouraging manufacturers, basically, subsidizing growing and new nascent industries. So that's just up to number four. There are 11 points. The rest of it's all in the book, Rebooting the American Dream. And you can find it online. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There was a terrorist attack in London yesterday. You may have noticed it's not wall-to-wall on the news like terrorist attacks typically are. Why? Because instead of being an attack by Muslims on Christians, this was an attack by, let's just say somebody who didn't like Muslims on Muslims. And, we're still waiting to get all the details on who the attacker was and what his motivations were. But the guy was witnesses on the scene said that as he was taken out of the van, the driver, that he was like, kill all the Muslims, kill all the Muslims. So pretty grim stuff here. Very grim stuff, in fact. A whole lot of other things here. Mitch McConnell, Daily Kos is reporting, Joan McCarter. McConnell is still pushing for a vote on the still unwritten Trump care before the 4th of July. That's, you know, about 2 weeks from now. Nobody can see the bill. Nobody can see what's being written. Nobody, not even many of the Republicans in the Senate know what's going on. Because Mitch McConnell has got this thing in complete lockdown. This is Mitch McConnell who in 2009 went on national television and lied to us all saying that Obamacare was passed in the dark of night, in secret, blah-de-blah, after there'd been 20 open hearings, hundreds of amendments proposed by both Democrats and Republicans. It had gone through a committee process that was open and transparent, and it took, you know, a year to do Obamacare. Trump care apparently is going to take 2 weeks. And it's apparently going to be done in secret, behind the scenes. And the only thing that could slow it down to the point where Americans can have some outrage about this is if the Democrats in the Senate refuse consent. Now, what this essentially means is that they're going to stand up and say, you know, the Republicans are going to say, okay, we want to, you know, move along from the order of business here to the vote. Right. And if everybody consents or if nobody withholds their consent, then they go right to the vote. And this is not something that can stop it. If Democrats do this, they can only delay it by a few days to maybe at the very most a week or two. But it's an important gesture. And last week I asked last Thursday and Friday, what we thought we knew was that the Democrats were not planning to withhold consent. Because they figured, oh, you know, this is a battle that, you know, we're going to lose anyway. So why upset the Republicans? I can't believe I said that. But yeah, that actually was the rationale that I read from one Democratic strategist. Well, I suggested that you called your members of the Senate. I'm not taking credit for this. And I don't know if our calls had anything to do with it. But the report over the weekend is that Chuck Schumer and the Democrats are going to refuse consent. They're going to withhold consent, which is good news, I think. It's good news. So anyhow, 2 year calls, anything goes summer. Jose in Riverdale, Georgia. Excuse me. Hey, Jose, yeah, what's on your mind?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah. I'm calling because I just found your program. I didn't even know that it existed.
Oh, well, thank you.
but I called to talk about this because I believe we have been living into hate and extremism. That's why you have that attack in England that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And probably that's why that ship off of Japan ran a Navy ship. Because they don't talk much about it. But
you think that was malicious? You think that was malicious? I just figured the captain was asleep or drunk. Jose, your phone is breaking up.
Yeah, my phone is bad. Yeah. I'm going to have to cut out then. Sorry. Yeah. Bye.
Okay, you want to try it again? No? Okay. All right. Thanks, Jose, for the call. Aaron in Berea, Kentucky. Hey, Aaron, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was just wondering, we all know that production of opium has just exploded in Afghanistan since we invaded.
Yep.
I was just wondering how much is anyone tracking where this stuff goes? Like, I'm wondering how much of it is ending up in Big Pharma's hands.
Probably none of it. Big Pharma gets most of their opium from New Zealand, where it is grown on giant, 10, 50, 100,000 acre farms that under pretty rigorous controls. And that's one of the major exports of New Zealand. They're the principal opium supplier to the world for pharmaceutical purposes. I doubt any of it is any of the stuff coming out of Afghanistan is going to pharma. Most of it is going to Europe and Russia and the former Eastern Soviet states. And some of it is coming to the United States. And this was a big problem back in 2000, 2001, which is why George W. Bush gave between $20 and $40 million. I'd have to look up the exact amount to the Taliban to burn the opium poppy fields, which they did in 2001, in the fall of 2001, just before 9/11. And for the next year, there was virtually no opium production in Afghanistan. They took the money, they burned the fields, and, you know, it was an amount of money equal to, roughly equal or a little more than, you know, enough to pay for the political layer on top of it, for the farmers to be happy, you know. We would go to the farmers and say, okay, you know, you've got a crop, you're going to get $20,000 for it, here's $20,000, burn the crop. They're saying, fine. And then, of course, when George W. Bush started dropping bombs on Afghanistan, and what was that, somewhere between November of 2001 and February or March of 2002, as I recall. I'd have to go back and look and find exactly when he started dropping bombs on them. But that was the point at which all bets are off, and then opium production just exploded after that.
Yeah, I just noticed that, like, since the invasion, it's really around the time that the overdoses and stuff started here, when people started getting hooked on, you know, the heroin and the pain pills and all that.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
That, you know,
I mean, part of the, you know, one of the things that George W. Bush was reacting to in 2001 when he made that payment to the Taliban to burn the opium fields was he was reacting to pressure from Eastern European leaders and from Russian leaders. And, you know, from I don't know if Medvedev or Putin was in charge at that point in time, but, you know, there was a major, major heroin epidemic going on in Europe and in Russia at the time. And it was because the cost of a hit of heroin had gone down to the equivalent of around $5 US. And after they burned the fields, it went up to $15-$20 US, which caused a lot of people to stop using it. And it would be real interesting to know the provenance of a lot of the heroin in the United States. Although what's coming in now is synthetic opiates, fentanyl. Fentanyl is 100 times stronger than heroin, and it's manufactured in a laboratory. It doesn't require a vegetable-based substrate. It's made out of just raw chemicals, and that appears to be being manufactured right now in China and in North Korea. And that's, you know, going via Central and South America into the United States and starting to kill a lot of people. So it's a tough one. Aaron, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Queen in New York City. Hey, Queen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. And thanks for watching us on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. We've got to figure out a way to get the word out that we are literally in every household in New York City or in Manhattan. And I'm really glad you found us, Queen. What's up?
Well, I'll make sure that I'll continue to spread the word out.
Thank you.
What I wanted to say to you is that I want all the neighbors, whether you're in residential neighborhood or in the apartment, please send out a little note to say we care about everybody's religion. We respect everybody's religion. And if you have something in your heart to do harm, do not do it, because we know in all religions that we respect and care about. They are good people. That's what I want to put out, because that is what I am doing. And I thank you for your time and your love. I know you love the Constitution. And I just want everybody to please get that message out so we can stop hurting each other.
Amen.
In my building, we are from all different countries. We speak numerous languages. We don't have any incidents. No problem. Building here over 50 years. No problem. So thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Queen. Great to hear from you. And thanks for checking us out on Manhattan Neighborhood Network or watching us. Dion in Round Lake, Illinois. Hey, Dion, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching us on YouTube.
Yes, I'd like to talk about the college stuff. And I was looking at an advertisement for Duke University. I think it's $100,000 in tuition now.
Really?
Plus interest rates if you take out a loan.
Whoa.
Now, they were advertising affordable tuition, but if we took a Marty McFly in a time machine with Doc and they went back to the 1940s and 1950s, what do you think the price of the tuition will be? You think it will be more affordable back then?
Well, I know when my mom graduated from Michigan State University in 1949 or maybe 1950, I'm pretty sure it was 49. That her tuition was less than $100 a term, and she was carrying a full load. And I know that, you know, for the brief period of time that I went to Lansing Community College and Michigan State University, I was able to pay for it by working part-time in a gas station, at an Esso station, changing tires and pumping gas, and part-time at Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing, as a dishwasher, and then a short gig as a cook, and one day as a waiter when all the waitresses marched out in protest because the guy running the restaurant was kind of a pig. But college used to be affordable, Dion. It was, you know, I went to college in the late 60s, and I had only, out of all the people I knew, only one of them had any college debt at all, and he was a guy who was working on his master's degree. And
did they need to depend on scholarships back then, or no?
Yeah, no,
financial aid?
I think absolutely we should. College should be free. You know, I'm with Bernie on this, and frankly, with the Democratic Party platform, college should be free in the United States. It's an investment. What we know from the GI Bill, when we made college free to all the young men who returned, and a few women, but mostly men, who returned from World War II, was that for every dollar that we invested in college, over the next 40 years, we received 7 additional tax dollars that we wouldn't have gotten because of their education.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But invest is not a word that Republicans are willing to use in the context of government spending. They always try to put it in terms of cost. Not a cost, but an investment. And welcome back. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about harassment of Muslims. Mm-hmm. There was a local incident here that happened where a evangelical Christian planted himself on a Friday in front of a mosque. It's called the Islamic Center, and most of the mosques are in, you know, mostly like office buildings, because I think they're sort of afraid to build, you know, big buildings. And it was very interesting. Apparently, he had a camera, and he was evangelizing the heathen. And he even asked one woman if she had a bomb underneath her burqa. I did ask him the question, or, you know, made a comment. I said, well, you know, why are you here on the phone?
You were there?
Beg your pardon?
You were there?
Yeah, I was there.
So you talked to the guy harassing the Muslims?
Oh yeah, he was very much so. He, planted himself out there with a huge billboard that he had to carry by a very, very big pole, and he had a camera strapped to him. It was very, very odd, but apparently these kinds of things are happening more and more around the country. And I just wanted to say, you know, the Muslims have been here now for probably about 30 years. And in the 25 years that I've lived here, they've revitalized a good portion of the city, including that very 10-block area where this mosque is.
Right, something immigrants typically do, by the way.
Yeah, and that, you know, I think that people need to understand that these people are very hardworking. They came here. They started businesses. They're in the professions. I work with a lot of them at the hospital I work with. Work at, rather, and the investment that they have made, you know, across this country. I think right there in D.C., the Somali community, it's the second largest Somali community outside of Minneapolis. And, I think that people need to think about that when, you know, they essentially harass, Muslims and try to make their life difficult, and all they're doing is coming and worshiping at that mosque, and they weren't paying much attention to him, but eventually the police did come, and I think they asked him to move. They didn't arrest him or anything because he was expressing his free speech rights. Mm-hmm. But apparently, I think there's two things going on there. There's a lot of racism, a lot of fear of Muslim immigrants. And of course, you know, we also have the Nanitz case here, Philando Castile, who was, I think, really murdered by a policeman not too far from.
Yeah, I don't understand how anybody could see that video that Philando Castile's girlfriend streamed live on Facebook and not.
Well, you know, yeah, they did not allow that in the court.
Oh, really?
No, that's from what I understand. They did not show that. The prosecution didn't show it, so I think it was like a deal. You know, I mean, in other words, you know, they went with, we're going to charge him with manslaughter, but then wink, wink.
Right. It was a wink, wink, nod, nod thing. Oh, that's tragic. John, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. And, of course, Philando Castile's killer got off, which I just don't understand at all. I mean, the murder of this man, or at least the death of this man, was filmed, was streamed live on Facebook by his girlfriend. And I've had, you know, at least one caller say that it was not allowed as evidence into the court, which baffles me. I can't verify that. I wasn't there. But... How that was not murder, if not at the very least manslaughter, I just don't get it. But that's the American criminal justice system. Pretty much any cop can kill any unarmed black man in the United States and get away with it. It just seems to be the case. Sam in Rose City, Michigan. Hey, Sam, what's up? Sam, you are on the air.
Hello.
Hey.
Yeah, Tom.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Hello. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I don't think anybody's really paying attention to Trump doing these things to Cuba, because I think he's in cahoots with the Russians, and they're going to be moving in.
Nah.
To Cuba.
Nah.
You don't think? Don't think so?
I really don't. Frankly, I doubt Russia these days has any interest in Cuba, number one. And number two... the Castro brothers are on their way out. In fact, what's his name? Fidel and what's his brother's name? Raul. Thank you. Raul has just announced that he's going to resign. You know, later this year or early next year. And this was just pandering. This is Trump is going down the checklist of everything that Obama did. That history will say this was an accomplishment of the Obama administration. And Trump is trying to delete every single one of those so that when they're all done. I mean, this is the reverse of the Reagan legacy project. After Reagan left office, amid scandal, the whole Iran-Contra, you know, selling Iran weapons in the middle of an embargo that we ourselves declared, selling Iran weapons in exchange for their holding the hostages in 1980 long enough that Jimmy Carter could lose the election. And it's just this is where we're at on this. So, the Reagan Legacy Project, the essence of the Reagan Legacy Project was they tried to put a statue of Ronald Reagan in every single county in the United States and in every country in the world, which they've pretty much done, including renaming the airport here. The reverse of that is to try to delete from everybody's memory a presidency, an 8-year presidency, and that's Obama. And that's what the Republicans are doing right now. It's the anti-Obama legacy project. And I'm convinced that that's why Trump went after Cuba. And, of course, he went down to little Havana and had a hand-picked audience of hardcore, mostly elderly right-wing Cubans to dance it to. Sam, thanks for the call. Trace in Corinth, Mississippi. Hey, Trace, what's on your mind?
Yeah. I was listening and talking about how these cops are getting away with murder and all. And just a couple of weeks ago, my cousin was beaten nearly to death by an off-duty police officer.
Really?
And they've even come up with this big cover story that sheriff's all taking up for him and everything.
Yep.
And... I don't know. You know, it's what do you do? How do you fight them? Who do you go to? That's the biggest issue. Who do you go to try to get something done?
Well, this the problem, Trace, whether your cousin was white or black or whatever, I mean, the problem is that the institution of policing in the United States has over the centuries, has grown in large part without any kind of meaningful oversight and restraint or constraint by the people that are being policed. And, I mean, this is particularly true of communities of color and poor communities that are not politically well represented. But it's also true of all of us. And, you know, unless a cop kills a billionaire or a multimillionaire, they're going to coast. And we need federal policing standards. I realize this is generally considered a states' rights issue, but there need to be some federal standards and the federal civil rights laws need to be applied more rigorously and more vigorously to policing, in my opinion. Trace, got to move along, but thank you for the call. Peter in Harmony, Rhode Island. Hey, Peter, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, can you hear me well?
Yeah, got about a minute and a half, Peter.
All right, so for 2018 and 2020, I think one of the ways to fight voter suppression in open primary states is to register as a Republican. I know psychologically speaking, I would probably make me want to vomit if I did that. But if you live in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, North Dakota, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, and Wisconsin, those are open primary states. And
right.
If Republicans are up to their tricks, you can register as a Republican.
But they're ahead of you, Peter. They're ahead of you. They are not using registration status. That registration status does not show up in the cross-check database. They're using ethnicity. They know that the majority of Latinos, African-Americans, and Asian-Americans vote Democratic, and so that's who they're targeting. They know that college students and people over 65 typically majority vote Democratic because, you know, they're interested in free college and Social Security. So they're going after those people, too, but, you know, with the ID laws. But the cross-check where they bump you off the voting roll altogether, that's if your name appears or a name similar to your name appears on the voting rolls of some other state. And then they say you're trying to vote in two states. And that doesn't have to do with party affiliation. So unfortunately, registering as a Republican won't do you any good.
Yes, but when it comes to actually registering, like they tried to do in Georgia, and they wouldn't even register the Democratic voters. When it comes to initial registration.
No, those were Korean. There was a Korean group, Korean American group, and a black group that were registering voters. And the state of Georgia shut them both down because Karen Handel, the Secretary of State, knew that, you know, the Korean Americans and the African Americans tended to vote Democratic. And so she bleached the 6th district, got rid of a lot of Korean voters and a lot of African American voters, and now she's running tomorrow in the election. It's pretty grim. Peter, thanks for the call. I get where you're coming from. I absolutely do, and I wish it was that simple.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.